Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen, episode number 53. I'm your host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today, our guest is Kasim Shepherd. He is a distinguished lecturer in architecture and urban studies at the City College, part of the City of University of New York. Trained as an urban planner, geographer, and documentary filmmaker, Kasim provides nonfiction media about cities and places with a particular emphasis on housing and civic life. His film and video work about cities around the world has been exhibited at the Venice Architecture Biennale, the Museum of the City of New York, the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum, the United Nations, Pavilion de l'Arsenal in Paris, and the African Center for Cities in Cape Town. His current exhibition, Mass Support, running at CCNY's Spitzer School of Architecture through May 7th, with a symposium scheduled for April 26th, explores the legacy and the contemporary relevance of Stichting Architekten Research, SAR, an architectural think tank active in the Netherlands between 1964 and 1990, which proposed a radical new way of thinking about mass housing. And the essential gambit there, as I understand it, was to fuse industrial production with mass customization, which is a concept that has strong implications for today's urban issues. Kasim, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess we would kick it off with a general orienting question, which would be, what is SAR and what inspired you to study it? I don't know that everyone's familiar with this.
Yeah, no, it is. They are not the most famous architectural think tank in the world. Not that any architectural think tank is that famous. But I really do think a lot of the ideas that the SAR is normally how people refer to it, and its founding director, an architect who I think of as more of a housing theorist, John Abrocken, ideas that really, really have a lot of relevance today. So my own research, my own academic research, is really sort of tracing different ideas of user involvement in housing environments around the world, particularly in the second half of the 20th century. So in my own research, this runs from, you know, upgrading of informal settlements in the global south to what was happening in upper Manhattan and in the 70s and the disinvestment crisis and how people sort of got involved in rehabilitating abandoned apartment buildings. So my own research really runs the gamut of a lot of different approaches to self-help or incremental approaches to housing. But in really trying to look at where a lot of these ideas originated, and actually originated within architecture, not within housing policy necessarily, or other places where people were thinking about housing emergencies, led me to the work of John Abrocken, who wrote a very influential book that came out in Dutch in 1961 and in English in 1972. The English title is Supports. But the original Dutch title, if you translated it literally, would be Supports and People. And at the core of this idea was really the notion that the way in which we were doing mass building throughout throughout Europe, in the context in which he was originally reacting to, particularly after World War II and the massive destruction that the Netherlands, where he's from, was encountering, was really sort of removing the human relationship between where somebody lived and how they felt about that place. And so in an effort to reintroduce a sense of agency on the part of residents, John Abrocken developed this idea of supports and infill, which was essentially to decouple the two components of any sort of building, separate the design responsibility for those elements that were relatively permanent, which he called the support or the superstructure, from those that were should be more flexible or more ephemeral, which in the case of a mass apartment building or a large apartment building would be the individual units. So there was a deep commitment to the diversity of households and a deep resistance to the homogeneity that post-war mass construction had sort of visited upon the Dutch people. John Abrocken, interestingly, grew up not in the Netherlands, but in what is now Indonesia, in the Dutch West Indies. And he spent a lot of time growing up observing how people in the place where he grew up, in Bandung, in central Java, were very capable of meeting their own housing needs, right? It's a little bit ironic that this idea had to be invented when, for the vast majority of human history, people have built their own housing. So the notion that we suddenly couldn't do that in 20th century cities was something that seemed a little bit silly to him, and he really wanted to reintroduce a notion of agency, a notion of user participation into building. So that's what led me into studying the work, both his own written work, but that also of this think tank, of which he was the founding director, the SAR, which really tried to operationalize this idea, really tried to sort of come up with ways of studying design practice, studying how architecture was working at this time. This was in a context in the Netherlands where 1 million units of housing had been built between the end of World War II and 1961. And that's on a base population of, you know, 12, 13 million, right? So an enormous amount of housing was built. And while a lot of it was, you know, architecturally ambitious, and some of it was good, some of it was bad, but what was definitely true was that it was almost 100% two-bedroom apartments. And one of the things that the SAR really focused in on is that's not how everybody lives, right? That's not people's needs change over time. You know, kids leave home. Elderly parents move in, people go through divorces, people have to work from home, right? So there was a big commitment to how can we actually build at this scale, right? They were not interested in boutique one-off experiments of flexibility, right, which was very much the rage in the 60s. They were interested in a systematic approach to introducing flexibility and the agency of users into the building stock. So the exhibition really takes that as a point of origin, really dives into how they formulated their methodologies, how they did their really intense user research. They were really into surveys and intense consultation. This was a period of time when the influence of environmental psychology was starting to make itself known within architecture. So they did a lot of, you know, ethnographic surveys of different household types to really try and understand how you could introduce flexibility within the context of huge amounts, dramatic increases in housing supply. And that's something that's very relevant today. I'm based in New York City, and, you know, we'll know soon if this goes through in our state budget, but our governor is currently trying to dramatically increase housing supply in New York State by 800,000 units over the next 10 years, and doing so in a way that is kind of riding roughshod over a lot of local zoning codes, in an effort to really sort of stimulate that housing production. And so the notion that there are some historical precedents for how you can dramatically increase the supply of units without sacrificing the self-determination of residents and neighbors and neighborhoods is something that should be very interesting to the policy community, not just to architecture at this moment.
Wow, thank you for that. In a companion essay that you wrote related to this project and your study of John Abraken, you argue that he had a fundamental belief that the more rigid the underlying structure, the more flexible and varied the permutations could be above. Now, that seems counterintuitive. Can you elaborate a bit on it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, they were really into grids. And if we think about it again, using New York as an example, you know, we have a pretty well-defined street grid in most of Manhattan, with some interesting variations, but for the most part, you know, this was developed in 1811 as a pretty extreme play, assuming that there would be, you know, a big bet on the possibility of Manhattan's growth. And if you look at the amount of variation upon it, it kind of helps to prove the point. We've actually designed the exhibition at the Spitzer School of Architecture to reflect this. So on the floor is the optimum grid that the SAR decided after much experimentation was perfect for their support and infill projects, which is basically sort of a square meter, then a square half meter, square meter, and then a square half meter. This was the raster grid that they decided was most appropriate for their flexible wall systems. So to give you an example of what they actually were proposing, and they worked hand in hand in the Netherlands in the 60s and 70s with industry, and really at a moment in time when there was a huge amount of optimism about the potential for prefabrication, right? And in order to do that, they needed all of the buildings that were designed following the methodologies that the SAR developed to meet certain standards so that these infill packages, which were essentially movable walls that had building systems built into them, electricity and plumbing, could be repositioned by users when units changed hands or families moved away or a family needed to expand or a family needed to contract. But in order for that amount of variation to really work at a building systems level without having to get a general contractor back into the mix, right? It needed to have a lot of standardization at the base level in terms of how those systems connected to urban systems of water and electricity in particular. This was before people were thinking about fiber optic connections as well. So we just had those two major ones. And so that was the solution. And they tried out a bunch of different grids, and they really thought that this one was the most, this square meter, square half meter, square meter, square half meter, 10 by 20 raster grid is what how they referred to it, as the way to go about that, to really sort of improve the possibility of flexibility or the potential of flexibility through standardization that wasn't necessarily visible at the unit level, but was very much built into how the original support structure was created. But I should emphasize that the flexibility that they were talking about was not exclusively in terms of this technical solution, right? This wasn't a fundamentally a technical proposal. It's certainly not from John Abrocken's point of view. His suggestion was much more about responsibility, right? And about the who is in charge of what and who is responsible for what decision at what point in time. And how can we as architects design things that anticipate future uses that we can't possibly know at this particular moment in time? How can we design with that kind of uncertainty? Yes, at a technical level, it requires a certain level of standardization, and that particular grid was their solution for that. But even more significant, I think, than the possibility of moving walls was the amount of time they dedicated to consultation with residents, right? They thought up to a third of any design process should be deeply involved in specific consultation with residents about their needs. The amount of time that they spent sort of systematizing methodologies to make it relatively efficient for architects across the country, across the Netherlands, that is, to meet with prospective clients, to understand their uses. That, I think, is a lesson that's even more applicable today than the technical solution of prefabricated movable walls with systems in them. And so that kind of flexibility doesn't necessarily require a grid, but it does require a really specific attention to the methodology of user engagement and community engagement, which, as we know, are hugely contentious and problematic areas of architectural practice today, particularly when you're thinking at the scale that they were thinking of, which was essentially changing an entire national culture of building.
Yeah, and I mean, that's obviously not easy to do at any scale. I'm just thinking about, you know, the ever-resurgent enthusiasm for modular and prefabricated construction that seems to pop up in architecture and construction circles every few years, and the attempts at it, you know, have been pretty marginal or pretty blah. You know, you're looking at something like a Holiday Inn. Okay, that's prefabricated. That's a good example of prefabrication working. But when you start talking about permanent residences, it's a little different. And part of it seems to me, at least in, maybe this is just in the United States, but there's been a lot of resistance from the trades who would be displaced by, you know, machined work, replacing them on the site. I know this was a big point of negotiation, for example, with the Pacific Park project in Brooklyn, with the, was it the related companies? No, it was Forest City Ratner. It was such a big deal that the construction company that they contracted with bowed out of the deal, and they had to, you know, completely reorganize the whole labor system. So yeah. I was curious whether there was consultation with labor in the development of this process, and if they were intimidated by it, and, you know, what the implications might be for labor the way that it's allocated today.
No, that's a really great question. In the context of the historical examples of the SAR, their labor was very much at the table, but that's a slightly non-transferable model because of the way the Netherlands works. It's particularly at that time where there was sort of a pretty tight relationship between building fabricators and their labor force. And there wasn't quite the same distinction that we have between trades and shop-based contracts. And so essentially, I think a lot of what the implications are for labor is that this is not 3D printing of houses, right? This is very much involves a labor force, but much more on a on a industrial production model rather than an on-site trades model. One of the speakers in our symposium on April 26th, which is really looking at a lot of contemporary projects that resonate with some of the Tsar's ideas, runs a company in Chicago called Inherent Homes, a guy named Tim Swenson, who's thinking a lot about local construction economy in terms of having sort of a Fordist model of housing production, where he's training, and very much talking to the trades in terms of look at the dips in your enrollment numbers. You know, this doesn't seem like a great industry to get into if every time there's a pandemic or every time there's a slowdown, you know, the jobs, the on-site construction jobs dry up. But if it was more of a shop model, if it was more of a factory, and you're not as, you're creating an inventory as opposed to doing everything bespoke, it is a little bit more insulated from some of those boom and bust cycles. And he's really committed to training people to build the components of these modular homes that they themselves can purchase, right? It's very much, I want to train people how to build homes that they're able to afford. I mean, the other aspect of the question, which goes a little bit beyond the labor question, which is a really important one, and I'm glad you brought it up, Daniel, is the we're really sort of trying to point at examples of prefabrication or modularity that go beyond what we typically think of as the problems that prefab solves, right? So while the majority of the exhibition is dedicated to this legacy of the Tsar, of this sort of somewhat obscure Dutch think tank from the 60s, it's surrounded on the walls of the gallery by 10 contemporary projects that normally wouldn't necessarily be in the same conversation, right? We got some high-scale luxury buildings, we got some social housing, we got some advocacy around suburban retrofits, but we also have two very interesting prefab projects that, as I say, are solving problems that we don't think of as the typical problems, right? As you mentioned, prefab is great for things that are very standardized. Dorms, hospitals, Holiday Inn, right? Places where you have all the bathrooms in one line, right, on top of each other, so it makes it very efficient. The conversations we often have about prefab are about efficiency and cost, right? Turns out it's not always that much cheaper, right? Which immediately makes the argument for it, if you're only arguing in terms of efficiency and cost, go out the window. But it turns out, as some of the projects we're displaying point out, they might be able to solve other problems. So we have a project that originated in China, developed by the People's Architecture Office, which actually started, and this is, you know, again, super counterintuitive, as a historic preservation play, right? Thinking about these historic fabric of Hutong neighborhoods in Beijing and Shenzhen that are constantly under threat of demolition by municipal authorities under the argument that they're dark and dank and don't have modern living conveniences, but it's really just a real estate play to erase this historic fabric and create something denser, right? And what People's Architecture Office has proposed is this panelized system of a what they call the plug-in house, right, which you can assemble with just an Allen wrench in one day. And they've actually created these really beautiful prefabricated system of these panels where you can assemble these systems and actually use it literally to plug into historic fabric, help to support that some of that failing historic fabric, literally support it from falling down, as well as totally eviscerate the argument that these neighborhoods can't be upgraded without total destruction, right? And now that same system is now being deployed in the U.S. It's being used by a homeless services organization in Austin to create temporary tiny homes communities for the unhoused. Another prefab project that we're displaying is by Gans & Company. Deborah Gans has this incredibly innovative system, the first time prefab has ever mixed wood and steel, in which her office was responding to the Build It Back Better program after the destruction of Superstorm Sandy, and was able to work with certain group of families who were displaced from parts of Brooklyn and Queens to build new homes that were modularly constructed, but done so in a way with a tremendous amount of user customization. So we actually even have these long spreadsheets of all the different variations that they were able to make in terms of the choices that residents had in terms of having a double wide or having a two-family structure. And these buildings look very much like the vernacular housing of a lot of coastal Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island, with the exception that they're on stilts, so this doesn't happen again. But the tremendous amount of variation and a tremendous amount of user consultation that we don't normally associate, because the goal here was actually flexibility. It was not just efficiency and cost. Turns out it wasn't that much cheaper. It happened a lot faster, though, than it would have had under traditional construction. But it did account for a great level more flexibility and more customization on the part of those residents than would have been possible with traditional construction. So you can actually find things, if you switch the question of what the problem is you're trying to solve, where these things can actually move out of the way in which they often fail, because we're thinking about them purely in economic terms and not in terms of creating greater agency or greater flexibility.
You know, one of the things that you did in the exhibition that I thought was kind of fun and thought-provoking was to place an image of two other projects that I probably wouldn't have thought of for such an exhibit based on the brief, which was Levittown in Long Island and the Nakagin Capsule Tower, which unfortunately was recently demolished due to, various forms of demolition by neglect. But that was kind of an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, and it's a great episode of your podcast on the Nakagin Capsule Tower. So if anyone hasn't heard that, I encourage you to listen to it, because it's a fascinating building that definitely, I mean, you know, it also brings up, as you point out, probably the most important issue facing any discussion about housing today, which we don't necessarily go into in huge depth in the exhibit. But of course, you know, no amount of building technology, no amount of construction method, no amount of innovative typology of housing is going to solve these structural issues. It's maintenance, 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 right? Those are the most important issues in terms of our existing supply of housing. However, it is true that a lot of these ideas of prefabrication and modularity and the promise of industrial production of housing has been associated, and you know, there was a great exhibit about it at MoMA a decade or so ago, Home Delivery, which really sort of mentioned the fact that so often prefab is associated with a certain kind of utopia, right? That this is going to be infinite, limitless choice, whether that is, you know, the modules for a Japanese businessman having a pied-à-terre and living small, or whether that's a you know, middle-class white family using the GI Bill in order to build wealth in a greenfield development, right? Both of these are big, sort of ambitious cultural plays, right, that are using the promise of industrial production of housing or the promise of modularity or the promise of prefab to meet some sort of grand social ambition. And so that very much, the reason they're in the exhibition is to demonstrate the fact that, you know, this wasn't a completely unique set of ideas, right? This was in a context of a lot of need for new ideas, especially in the early 70s, coming out of the perceived failure of high-rise mass housing, right, which is most demonstrably encapsulated in the destruction of Pruitt-Igoe, right, in St. Louis. And this notion that that was really sounding the death knell, somewhat prematurely, I might argue, of high modernist ideals in terms of mass housing, right? That had been percolating over the previous decade. This notion that high-rise housing couldn't possibly work. It would always lead to social failure. It would always lead to all these patterns of neglect that would lead to patterns of violence, et cetera, et cetera. Again, the real culprit, not the architecture, maintenance, 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 right? And particularly in the United States context, when questions of structural racism are also involved, that becomes a much more politically loaded question very immediately. However, in the context of this exhibition, the idea was really to show that these ideas were very much in harmony with a bunch of other sort of experimental ideas that were bubbling up around the perceived failure of traditional modernist, rigid, you know, tall mass housing, but really kind of took those in a way that was neither boutique like Nakagin, or utopian, like some of the other projects that are on that same wall that you're referring to, you know, work by Hendrik Hertzberger and other sort of people thinking about the use of play and the need for flexibility in terms of free open space, right? I mean, there's a lot of thinking that was going on here that was really trying to get away from the rigidity of exterior form. And what we're trying to do is talk about the notion that those kinds of formal innovations in terms of the exterior of a structure or the, you know, the bulk of a structure or the height of a structure don't really do that much to restore what John Abrocken refers to as the natural relationship between a person and their dwelling if all the units inside those buildings are the same size, right, are the same layout. Are fixed not in terms of the underlying grid, but are fixed in terms of this is the only place you can have a living room, this is the only place you can have a kitchen. There's no possibility for growth or change, right? So we wanted to fit these ideas in the context of a lot of things bubbling up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, things as diverse as Levittown and the Nagarkand Capsule Tower, and then demonstrate how their ambitions went beyond any sort of one sort of, you know, philosophical or typological fix, but rather a series of methodologies and ideologies around user consultation, around the agency of residents, and about flexibility and designing for changes of use in the future that you can't possibly anticipate. Right. So they didn't talk about offices at all, for example, but I think a lot of their if we had heeded some of the calls that were coming out of this moment, this fertile intellectual moment in the 60s, maybe we would be thinking a little bit differently about our underutilized office buildings in Midtown Manhattan, for example. Right. So I do think we are in a moment now, anytime we're at the far end of a huge sort of contraction in the construction-based economy, as we've had after COVID, of thinking about different changes of use. And I think we would do well to revisit some of these funky ideas from earlier decades. None of them are perfect. None of them are panaceas, right? But one thing I often say about this moment of time, of which all the projects that we just mentioned were all sort of a part, is that we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, right? So my job as a historian of these ideas is to figure out what part was the baby and what part was the bathwater. And that's something that I'm hoping to do with this exhibit and with tying it to contemporary projects through the symposium as well.
All of these interventions and this participatory design approach, of course, was undertaken in the pre-digital era. You mentioned not accounting for fiber optics, but not really accounting for the fact that digital design was going to be a thing, which they couldn't have anticipated, to repeat the phrase. So now that we have all these digital capabilities, and I think Greg will probably have some more intelligent, specific questions to follow up, because this is definitely getting into his area of study. You know, we have the digital realm we inhabit today. What are the implications of participatory design, both for the exhibition and as a practical matter?
Absolutely. Well, I will one point of clarification. While they definitely weren't anticipating sort of the kind of interactive connections that we have technologically today, the SAR was very ahead of their time in terms of thinking about computer-aided design. But they thought of it not so much as a tool to aid with drawing or to replace drawing, but rather to perform a bunch of other functions that would enable architects and the architectural industry to understand those aspects of a building's life cycle that are traditionally outside of design expertise, like rent, financing, mortgages, you know, those kinds of things. So they actually developed their own computer programs, which we have some printout and displays of, and you can see that amazing sort of, you know, Apple Chicago font even before Apple, using it at that moment, where they created their own computer programs for Dutch municipalities to be able to calculate rent based on this huge disruption to how social rent or subsidized rent had traditionally been calculated, which was based on a standard unit size, right? And so they were able to do that in such a way that they could really, in their intense focus on working with users as well, use the computer as an interface for potential residents to understand the cost implications of how they wanted to personalize or configure their unit. And so while they used a lot of analog things as well, there was a big emphasis on one-to-one models. There's a photo in there of this, you know, these huge sort of flying walls on this grid system that's installed as cables above, so people could move their walls around on this pulley system to understand the implications in real space, one-to-one, of what that meant. Something that we've, you know, done with a 3D printed interactive model for one of the projects where people can move around the walls, you know, kind of like Legos on a table. My four-year-old loved it when he came to visit that part of the exhibition. But there was a big emphasis on using digital tools to understand the implications of some of that in terms of cost and in terms of these sort of non-architectural ideas that are so important in the success or failure of architectural projects. when it comes to how that influences design practice, that, you're right, is something that was maybe less on their minds at the time. But it does, there is also, you know, an irony there, right? You know, in the school where I teach architects, the Spitzer School of Architecture at City College, you know, students have been advocating that they want more training in BIM, right? In building information modeling, because that's what they're going to be expected to be fluent in when they get out there into the workforce, right? And a little bit of resistance to why are we drawing all the time, right? but that too has interesting implications in terms of flexibility and resident agency. If you're choosing a wall width from a drop-down menu as opposed to creating it, does that increase flexibility or does that limit formal innovation and expression? I mean, these are questions that people who are much more on the technology side and the software side are thinking about, with much more depth and nuance than I am. but I do think there are always questions that do lead into these counterintuitive spaces where you think the more flexible the tool, does that actually lead to more flexibility on the part of the finished form? Or does that actually lead to limiting of the possibility of different choices?
I want to jump in here and ask, you know, in addition to sort of the tools and the legacy there, I mean, obviously we can talk about the intellectual legacy of the SAR, but one question I have is there an actual living legacy today, or what are the pieces of it that can be picked up and put back to use? Because in addition to Dan's question there, I mean, one of the places I hang my hat intellectually is at MIT's Future Urban Collectives Lab, run by my friend Rafi Siegel. And Rafi, who like literally is an architect of kibbutzim and other sort of forms of communal housing, has also studied Baugruppen in Berlin and Germany. Like, we have all these sort of models of collective decision-making on more flexible footprints. Like, is this an idea whose time could come again? Like, can we resurrect this? And
absolutely.
Is there any direct legacy to projects today? Because it's funny you mentioned this one with the SAR. I'm unfamiliar with their work before really today, but like, I remember at the last Venice Biennale, there was a whole exhibit in the Finnish pavilion on their equivalent of this that did like 500,000 units of post-war housing. Like, the time in Europe was so ripe for that. But yeah, like, has anyone picked it up? Are the patents still in play?
Totally.
I'm curious, like, where if I want to go out and buy one, build one, where would we start?
It's a great question. So the answer is yes and no. If you want to go out and buy one and build one based on the SAR specifications, the answer is no. Our building, and one of the reasons that led to the SAR's eventual folding up shop in 1990 was the industrial partners who were building these infill packages just didn't see the demand that they thought that they'd been promised. Within building companies. That also had to do with a huge shift in Dutch politics around sort of private ownership that is a little bit too complicated to get into here. But so I think a much bigger part of the legacy that is much more important is in all of the things that you just mentioned, right? The Finns and the Swedes are at the forefront of thinking about prefab right now, Sweden in particular. And in doing so from a way that recognizes that the only way for it to actually scale up as something that can lead to greater environmental performance, to greater efficiency of cost, to a more circular use of materials and less waste, is if it happens through government mandates, where there's certain amount of new housing has to be produced using prefabricated or modular elements. But I think the more interesting legacy, and certainly the one that ties in more directly with my own research into agency and participation in housing, is something more like the Baugruppen, right? Which we do have three examples of in the contemporary projects portion of the show. Well, one is technically a Baugruppen, and two others are inspired by it. The Baugruppen project we have is, you know, something we would think of as co-housing, is the R50 project in Kreuzberg in Berlin, where the architects worked very closely with a group of residents who all wanted to live together, wanted to define their own decision-making system, wanted to develop their own building, that had certain amounts of flexibility built into the program of the building, but also was able to anticipate change in a particular way through not just the form of the building and the units, but through the governance of this sort of intentional community, if you will. And then while that project is essentially essentially co-housing, not social housing, right? It's essentially condos, just happens to be done through an intentional community model. It really paved the way for things that are actually subsidized and are reaching much more mixed demographic groups. Another project we have on display is a project called San Remo in Munich, which was very much designed by Sumo Kumpfemmer and Bureau Julian Greb, developed by this really interesting, very political developer called Cooperative Großstadt that assembled the land and invited a competition, actually, to design a social housing project that had a certain amount of flexibility and a certain amount of shared space, which, again, was very, very complicated for them to convince the municipal authorities was okay, because the way in which they calculate subsidy has to do with proprietary square footage. So the fact that so much of this space in this building, up to one-third of the usable space, is actually shared space, common rooms, common stairwells, in some cases common kitchens. Some of the floors are actually used by service apartments for people who need particular services. Other ones are traditional family groupings or untraditional family groupings. But what was really amazing, and this is the benefit of doing something like this in real space with an exhibition as opposed to just sort of writing about it, to see some of the resonances in the methodologies, the intense focus on people cutting out, you know, little models of what their bed is and getting down on the floor and writing out how it is they live, their patterns of their daily life, how that should inform the design of their building, is really something that ties directly back to the methodological experiments that the SAR was devising and conducting in the 60s and 70s for how to involve residents in their own process. And while the SAR was specifically focused on design methodology, I really do think some of the follow-on effects of that are going to have things to say about governance, about decision-making moving forward through time, not just at the co-design stage, but then how does that inform the way in which you feel about the community that you're in with the people with whom you share a building, particularly if those communities are not, you know, a bunch of friends, like in R50, which is a great precedent, but are people with very diverse needs, different mobility needs, different needs in terms of having a social worker on site versus just having a babysitter on site, right? How do those kinds of decision-making capacities about the program of the building, what the building is doing, right? You know, R50 famously had this big common space that was really important to them. And then a few years later, this was sort of a game room. A lot of the kids hung out there. But in 2016, during the manufactured crisis of refugees in Europe, they converted that into three apartments for three families from Syria and Iraq who lived there for a year and a half until they were able to find more permanent housing, as far as I understand. So there is, I think, the bigger sort of implication for this is more on the methodology and the ideology of long-term systems for group decision-making. And less on, like, here are the specifications for buying a movable wall. But in my view, both those things actually have much more to do with each other than we tend to think. Because to the extent that the SAR is remembered at all, it's remembered as the purveyors of this technical solution. And I actually think the technical solution, while fascinating, is the least resonant with our contemporary crisis. What is far more resonant with our contemporary crisis is the need to design systems that at root are about the flexibility and anticipation of change and the involvement and decision-making power of the people who are actually going to make that their home.
Yeah, and I think it's that specific lack of agency that has really upset people and driven so many of the, housing advocacy campaigns that we've seen over the past few decades and continue into this day. We actually just spoke with Brian Goldstein, who wrote a book about efforts in Harlem to reclaim what was happening in construction there for the community itself, with varying results. And obviously that's pretty close to where your school is, actually.
Yeah, in fact, he had a book event at our school about that.
Yeah, and I mean, so you know, like a lot of things that we talk about in this program, you know, it isn't a lack of interest in the architecture community or the urbanist community in making these things happen. Oftentimes there's a political will aspect to it that would make all these principles easier to execute. And a change from, you know, short-term sort of capitalistic turn of quick profit thinking to longer-term thinking. Do you foresee, or do you see anywhere currently where that seems to be underway, where it wasn't previously the case, that gives you hope that something like the SAR model will be repeated in the future?
I wish my answer was a resounding yes. I think that a lot of the contemporary projects that we have on display in the exhibition, I think, prove the point that these kinds of strategies need to be investigated further, and that we need a lot of different ideas. We need a lot of new ideas that we haven't thought of yet. We also need to examine the promise and the pitfalls of overlooked ideas from our recent past. So I do think that we are in a moment of extreme hunger for ideas, and I think part of the problem is that we're only looking for brand new ideas, but then we're only able to finance old ideas, right? Because that's what there's enough of a precedent for. So I think there is a value in unearthing overlooked precedents and drawing different connections between them, because I think the hunger is there. I don't see, as I look around the world, any sort of specific national or regional culture of building that's really taking this on. I mean, I think definitely in Northern Europe there is a culture of experimentation on the part of municipalities that's more able to absorb new ideas in ways that our particular regime of codes and laws feels particularly inflexible. So, you know, our symposium on flexibility and agency in housing today is on April 26th. The following night, part of a week of programming around these ideas, at City College, we're having our annual Lewis Mumford Memorial Lecture, which always attracts great luminaries of urbanism to City College campus. You know, it's had Marshall Berman and Rebecca Solnit and Jane Jacobs and Mike Davis in the past. This year, it's Emily Badger from The Times, and she's coming there to speak specifically about, you know, the title for her talk is Pressing Change in the Increasingly Inflexible City, right? Which really gets to the heart of the matter of why is making change so difficult, right? What are the barriers in the way? And if you look at, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking and talking and interacting with people who all want better, more attainable, higher quality, better designed housing. But the level of infighting within the housing advocacy community between those who want to strip away all regulation in order to, you know, allow supply to increase, between those who want much more stringent regulation to, you know, stem the tide of evictions, which leads to homelessness and leads to death, right? And the fact that these two people are not on the same side, but are actually fighting each other, I think points to both a hunger for pathways that can harmonize, the need for more flexibility in our laws, while also greater protections for those of us who are most vulnerable. But I don't necessarily see a huge uptick in any sort of systematic change to the culture of building, which is what the SAR was trying to foment. But I do think the hunger is there. So hopefully that can lead us in the right direction. I mean, when, you know, it's actually relatively recent that something like affordable, attainable housing has become something that's a national news issue, right? It's always been a hugely important local issue. But the fact that it's now a part of federal discussions, because it's not just a coastal blue state urban problem, right? You know, there are rent strikes in Boise, right? I mean, it's a tremendous challenge everywhere. And we do have some interesting precedents. You know, California has tried some things with transit-oriented development, with sort of restricting the ability of certain municipalities to underbuild, with allowing accessory dwelling units, et cetera. And all of those things are part of the conversation and need to be part of the conversation. But none of them are going to fully address the scale of the issue if they're not tied to larger ideological and methodological questions as well as the larger structural reality of why we have not enough housing in this country.
Cousin, we're almost out of time, but I want to come back to you've hammered it at several points, maintenance. The maintenance is the key to this. And I would love your thoughts on, taking the legacy forward, are there interesting radical experiments in how to think about that maintenance or self-maintain? I mean, I think of like 3D printing possible parts to replace things, or I think of Assemble, which won the Turner Prize for, they sort of hand cast pieces of dilapidated homes to remake them. I'm curious, what are the lessons out of that to think about, how do we maintain repair of this? Obviously, Dan will complete me, the recent Pritzker Prize winners, Vassal and...
Lacaton and Vassal.
Thank you. Lacaton and Vassal. I'm on 5 hours of sleep. But, obviously, Lacaton and Vassal have impaired upon this as well in terms of thinking about creative reuse. Yeah. So where do we take that aspect of the legacy forward? Not just the flexibility.
Oh, that's so important.
But, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, in the exhibition text that kind of tries to curatorially make the connection between the SARS work and the 10 contemporary projects, name checks Lacaton and Vassal and another Pritzker winner, Elemental, who did their incremental housing project in Iquique in Chile, as two sort of paragons of thinking about change and thinking about the capacity of residents to inform that change, right? So that's a hugely important issue that I really think architects really need to and are starting to contend with. How do you design these systems into it?
And I would say I do like the fact that Elemental, of course, made those plans open source afterwards. So tying that in where you can simply download the plans for your own half-built home. So it's interesting how they've opened up that. Yeah, please continue.
They've totally opened that up. Anyone can do it. I got excited when I saw that on their website. I thought that meant there were free images I could use in my exhibition, but no, it was the plans instead, which is even more useful. Actually, one of the more specific answers to your question, though, Greg, comes from one of the high-end luxury projects that we have on display. Two projects in the Netherlands by the same architect developer team. One is called Top Up, and one is called Patch 22. And these are not intended to have any sort of government subsidy or address sort of the affordable housing issue. But they're taking the STAR methodology in very literal ways, not in its ideological terms, but in its methodological terms, right? In really about allowing for different use and about enabling, creating systems where the residents can actually draw their own sketches of what the building should be, and then the architect has offered to create those into building documents, right, to translate them. But more important than that is simple things coming from a perspective of trying to maximize environmental performance, like a hollow top of the floor, right, where you can remove very easily the top of the floor if you want to move your systems around or move your walls around without having to hire the general contractor back. And he talks about this, getting back to the labor question, as part of a circularity of construction, is the term he uses, not just in terms of the materials, but in terms of really enabling you to do that kind of maintenance work by hiring the guy who's really handy down the street, rather than a large company. So he's not anticipating that everybody has the construction know-how to remove the top of their floor themselves in order to create the new hookup for their moved wall. But he is thinking very, very systematically about how you could involve a more local supply chain of both materials and labor that is not as that doesn't have the same sort of overhead costs as the person who's making the foundation, right? So I think those kinds of designing those kinds of systematic approaches to maintenance and construction and change into the way the building is designed at first may actually lead to greater upfront costs, but it leads to a huge savings environmentally and financially down the road, because there's basically no demolition required for expansion, right? And that is a really important element, not just of change, which I think is the primary selling point of this, but also of core maintenance, right? And so I think if you design those systems, and if as architects, I teach the future architects of the world, and I'm always trying to encourage them to think from a design lens about these non-design questions, right? Finance, maintenance, chief among them. And those, we can think of those as creative design challenges. It shouldn't be the extra required class where you have to leave the building and go take economics, right? How can you actually make a cool diagram that demonstrates the different points of entry for other kinds of professionals outside of design expertise or large-scale construction companies and contractors to be a part of the life cycle of a building, involving residents more, also involving local construction economies more. And I think that that is an important design challenge that I have yet to see on, like, studio briefs or in the, you know, requests for expressions of interest from developers. So hopefully that will become more expected. And it's not that designers have to master all these skills all on their own, but they do need to have enough of an awareness to be able to design the endpoints for maintenance that can also be those same endpoints for the possibility of change over time.
Kazem Shepherd, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. This has been really enlightening. It's quite a different way of thinking about design and construction, and glad to help you expose the good works of SAR and get us thinking about how that might be applicable to the future.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Please, I hope your listeners can either tune in for part of our day-long symposium on April 26th, or come and see the exhibition at City College in Harlem until May 7th. And hopefully it'll travel, so maybe you'll get another chance to see the exhibition somewhere else in the world. Thanks so much for sharing these stories and other stories of architecture. It's really great to speak with you.